In Garth Greenwell's debut novel, What Belongs to You, an American teacher meets a charismatic young hustler named Mitko in the public bathrooms beneath the Bulgarian National Palace of Culture. The narrator begins a relationship with Mitko that exists beyond the parameters of a conventional romance, but has its own meaning and tenderness. Garth Greenwell, welcome to Books at Arts. Tell me, what does the narrator see in this character of Mitko?
One of the things I wanted to explore in the novel is kind of the complexity of sex work. I think it's very hard to talk about sex work in a way that doesn't kind of flatten it out. And I think it's a really complex phenomenon, especially maybe in a context where it occurs between men. I think part of that complexity comes from the fact that, you know, in a gay context, you know, many, many gay men have been on both sides of transactional sex. And there's a kind of fluidity to the role of, you know, client and sex worker that I think isn't true of sex work in a heterosexual context. And then there's also a way in which, you know, sex work can be a very kind of ambiguous thing. So there's actually only one moment in the book, that first scene where the narrator, where there's an explicit sort of give me this much money for this thing transaction. Everything else is much more ambiguous, and it's a question of gifts or things like that. But Mitko, you know, he lives in a state of real vulnerability, and yet on the other hand, or in another way, he does, I think, live life on his own terms.
Let's just give the reader a bit more of a sense of Mitko as he comes across in the book. Because, yes, we first meet him when there is this kind of exchange that happens in the men's bathroom. But really, right from the beginning, Mitko has these dual aspects. On one hand, there's a kind of air of menace, violence. He's often drunk. He's drunk when we and the narrator first meet him. But there's also a frankness, a guilelessness, a kind of just basic human friendliness that exists in this character.
I mean, I think that's a really beautiful description of him. I mean, I think it's true that, you know, he's a person who's capable of this extraordinary human warmth and openness and candor and kind of availability to the world. There's a phrase that the narrator uses in that first scene where he says that he seemed, speaking of Mitko, he says he seemed to have no squeamishness about existence. There's a way in which he seems comfortable in his own body and in the world for all of the kind of perilous contingency of his own existence. He seems, you know, sort of at ease and reconciled with the world in a way that the narrator is not.
Indeed, this is the big contrast that happens. And the whole book, the whole of What Belongs to You, comes from the narrator. The voices are all through his words. It's all through his perception. And the contrast between his fearfulness around himself and his identity, even though he's an out gay man in the way that Mitko isn't in a society like Bulgaria, is so striking. Tell me about this narrator. What's he doing in Sofia in Bulgaria?
So the narrator is a high school English teacher. And at the beginning of the book, you know, he's kind of at the beginning of his time in Bulgaria. He barely speaks the language. He can barely communicate with Mitko at the beginning of the book. We learn that he grew up in Kentucky in the early 90s. And I think one of the things, because I hope that the book is very much in conversation with a tradition of gay literature, you know, especially with books like, say, James Baldwin's Giovanni's Room. You know, this is a narrator who grapples very much with feelings of shame. And they're feelings of shame that are connected to his sexuality, but they're not exactly the feelings of shame that we encounter in gay literature of 30 years ago, because, you know, he's someone who for decades has been sort of steeped in the world and the language of gay activism. And so he's someone who understands that the lessons he was taught about his life growing up in the early 90s in Kentucky, and as in Bulgaria today, in Kentucky in the early 90s, queer people were taught a single lesson about their life, which was that their lives have no value and their lives have no dignity. And the narrator is someone who knows that those lessons are false, that they are bankrupt, and yet he is still the person who he is because of those lessons. Mm. I mean, he was shaped by those lessons. You know, it's a kind of queer sensibility or sort of a queer subjectivity that has been shaped by a shame that it's rejected.
Indeed. And what, I mean, I think this is what's so wonderful about a novel as opposed to maybe a psychology textbook, in that the novel explores the complexity of this for a character and the lived emotional experience. So on one hand, yeah, there is shame, and partly the fact that the character meets Mitko in public toilets and that there is a transactional element always to their relationship, whether in cash or in food or in accommodation. So that feeds into a certain kind of shame and self-disgust. But it's also what turns him on. It's also what the narrator gets off on in this relationship. And it also opens up a kind of beauty between them. So it's not that the shame is the end of the story in terms of his relationship with Mitko. And he can't untangle the shame from the other kinds of perhaps more positive or, you know, liberating feelings that this relationship brings up for him.
I hope that that's also true of their relationship more broadly, you know, in the way that there's no question that that transaction with which their relationship begins continues to kind of shape and form and deform their relationship and limit that relationship. And yet what interested me in writing about these two characters are these moments where what they feel for one another seems to exceed that transactional structure, where their relationship, for all the ways that it seems determined by the differences between them, the sort of gulfs of privilege, of class, of nationality, of language, that there is a feeling and that there is a kind of potential that exists between them. So that, you know, it is a love story, and it's a strange and a strained love story, but it is a love story.
This is Books and Arts on ABCRN. I'm Sarah Kanoski, and I'm speaking with Garth Greenwell about his magnificent debut novel, What Belongs to You. It is a love story, Garth, and I think it does what great novels do, in that it opens up new kinds of relationships for a reader. You know, the sort of relationship that Mitko and the narrator have, it doesn't fit the conventional parameters of a romance, of a heterosexual romance, obviously. But there is moments of great sweetness and warmth and friendliness, but it's not going to last forever. It's not going to turn into something other than it is.
You know, one of the things I hope this novel does is I hope it explores places like these bathrooms beneath the National Palace of Culture in Bulgaria, these cruising places, which have been talked about in such reductive and dismissive and, you know, judgmental terms for so long. I hope that it explores these places and the kinds of relationships they enable in a way that recognizes the richness of those places and those relationships. And, you know, it's long been true in queer life that there has been a kind of articulation of the value of relationships that can be separated from duration. Really, you know, when I talk about cruising, I sometimes say that the great poet of cruising is Walt Whitman. And I think that's true. And, you know, Whitman's poems again and again, as he moves through a crowd, say, or through a city scene, he will form a connection with a singular other that lasts only a moment, and yet is infinitely valuable. And it does seem to me that my own life, because these, you know, cruising places have been central to my life since I was 14 years old, when I, you know, discovered Cherokee Park in Louisville, Kentucky, which was, you know, the first place where I found a queer community. These places enable face-to-face human encounters that engage the whole gamut of moral and ethical and emotional response. And I have certainly had experiences in these places that felt like, you know, moments of a genuine human recognition, and that felt deeply valuable to me. And even if they only lasted a few moments, I mean, even if I didn't exchange names with someone, why should that diminish the value of that recognition? Why should that diminish the value of not just the bodily pleasure given and received, but also a kind of care? I mean, a kind of affection and tenderness. And Whitman does not shy away from using the word love for those moments of recognition between individuals in a crowd. And it seems to me that, you know, any story we tell about queer lives needs to be able to accommodate these places and these relationships.
It makes the argument, or it reveals this book, the joy and the complexity and the heartbreak that's there between the narrator and the character of Mitko. Another great sort of story that this book tells is the narrator's upbringing in Kentucky and the pain about his relationship with his father, a sort of lost relationship, a lost physical intimacy with his father, as his father progressively rejects him as he grows from being a young child to a teenager. And there's a really beautiful scene where the narrator is out in the countryside in Bulgaria at a cafe by a river, and he witnesses a father just sort of playing closely with his young daughter, and everyone's kind of enjoying this scene of this very innocent, lovely physical intimacy between a parent and a child. And the narrator wonders about the intimacy of absolute possession that he's witnessing, and is filled with sorrow as it contrasts with his own sundering of closeness with his father.
Right. You know, there's this repeating motif in the book that I wasn't aware of until I was able to look back at the whole, of the narrator looking at very young children with their parents and imagining that what they are experiencing is this, as he says, this intimacy of absolute possession. And then, yes, in that middle section, he remembers moments when he remembers having that sense of possession with his own father. And I think, you know, for the narrator, he imagines childhood and his own childhood, which was so traumatic, and the book presents the moment when that intimacy or that possession was broken between him and his father. You know, he imagines that childhood is the one time in our lives when we can be absolutely sure what belongs to us. In that relationship with our parents, before we've, you know, if we've been lucky enough to be parented in a certain way, you know, when we feel sure of love and belonging, and when the idea that that bond with our parents might be broken like any other hasn't even, you know, occurred to us, it's unimaginable, that is sort of the one experience we have of that kind of certainty and that kind of belonging. And he does imagine that we lose that and we spend the rest of our lives trying to replace it.
And as a gay man in a homophobic society, he lost that in a very particular way. But the book suggests, the narrator suggests, that that's kind of a quality of being a person, is that we lose that surety, that givenness of that closeness, and that explains a kind of sorrow, a melancholy that is bigger than any class or sexuality. It's sort of what we experience as humans.
I think that is what the narrator sort of imagines. He does imagine this as a kind of universal experience. You know, what's specific to the kind of queer experience, or to the, you know, the narrator's experience of that break, is the violence of it and the disgust that he is taught to feel about himself. You know, this lesson that he's taught, that this isn't some sort of normal growing up experience, or this isn't some kind of normal separation, but that instead, you know, he is marked, and marked by his father, as monstrous.
And as you say, and as he acknowledges himself, these aren't lessons that can be unlearned, even when he knows rationally they're false.
I think that's right, because, you know, I mean, they mark him, they shape him. The very individual who is able to articulate all of the ways in which those lessons are false is the individual who was made by those lessons. And so that kind of woundedness, which I think does characterize the experience of a lot of queer people today, those queer people who are lucky enough to live in those extremely privileged places where a different kind of narrative about queer people is accepted and where the value of queer lives is affirmed. You know, that kind of woundedness, even in these places, these very lucky places of privilege, is something that I do think is characteristic of queer subjectivity at this moment. And it's a, you know, it does seem to me that in this kind of triumphant narrative that's sometimes told in those privileged places about gay liberation and about marriage equality, it has become almost impermissible to talk about that peculiar shame and that woundedness and to acknowledge that woundedness. And I think that's dangerous. I think any time it becomes impermissible or difficult or almost impossible to talk about feelings, you know, I think that's dangerous.
Garth, you talk about the tradition of queer novels that What Belongs to You exists in, but with its with the obsession with shame, with self-disgust, with the Eastern European setting, with the fact that most characters are just identified by a letter, I couldn't help but see echoes of Kafka here as well.
Oh, that's really interesting. I do think, well, I mean, you know, I think the novel is sort of both, you know. I mean, I think it is, a tradition is just a conversation between writers over time. And, you know, I think a book, like a person, engages in multiple conversations at once. And so, you know, to me, I mean, it is absolutely essential for my book that there's this very vital, very exciting conversation happening among queer writers over time. And queer writers like Thomas Mann and Henry James and James Baldwin and Edmund White and Alan Hollinghurst, without whose work my book absolutely could not exist. And then there's also, you know, a conversation that the book is having with other kinds of, with W.G. Sebald, and yes, with this tradition of Central European writing that would include Kafka, would also include Thomas Bernhardt. Mm. You know, I hope that the book is doing all of those things, you know, and claiming it as a queer book, which it is, and, you know, saying that it's a book written about queer stories for queer people, in that I'm not interested in trying to justify queer lives or make queer lives palatable to people who don't accept the value of those lives. That's not the project of this book. And so it is a book for queer readers. That does not in any way mean that it's not also a book that's engaging in, you know, the literary tradition as broadly conceived as possible. I mean, it's the strange alchemy of literature that by observing and narrating and digging into the particular as much as possible, literature arrives at the universal. It's not that this book is a queer book, but also a book that anyone can read. It's not queer but universal. It's queer and so universal. Because that's how literature works. We look at the specific, at the individual, and it's because we do that that we arrive at some resonance that is universal in the sense that it speaks to our common human experience.
Yeah, well, that's certainly my experience of this book as a reader. Garth Greenwell, thank you so much for your book and for talking to me about it on Books and Arts.
Thank you so much for having me.
And Garth Greenwell's debut novel, What Belongs to You, is published by Pan Macmillan. And we've put a longer version of that interview online if you're interested in hearing more from Garth. One of the things he talks about there is why it's important to write explicitly about queer sex